And welcome to a special edition of Second Sunday Book. I'm Libby Hellman, and my guest is Cara Black, and she'll be back in just a second. And I don't know when I've been more excited to talk to Cara. As you know, she's a good friend. I don't know if it was when Chloe was born and she have a kid, or if it's now, because this is Cara's very first standalone. It's called 3 Hours in Paris. And boy, is it a thriller. It's an amazing story. And we're going to get into that in just a second. But let me just do one little piece of housekeeping here. And that is to tell you that Second Sunday Books is a trademark podcast presentation, which is solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Okay, welcome, Cara.
Hey, Libby, thanks for having me again.
Oh, wow, it's my pleasure. I mean, this is such a different kind of situation because it's not AMA. So by the way, it's been getting wonderful reviews. You got a starred review from Booklist. You got a great review from PW. Tell us, Kirkus gave you a review?
Yeah, I think I got a starred review in Library Journal too. The Sunday Times in the UK reviewed it, which was out of the blue. The LA Times, Paula Woods, someone we both know, a writer, and sure. Paula gave it an incredible review. It's also, I think, an Amazon top 10 pick. And I'm just really surprised.
Really? It's on top 10 pick? I'm so jealous.
Oh, and it's a Indie Next Best list. So I'm just really thrilled. I'm kind of slow to the start because like 19 books it took me to write a standalone. And so many people as you and many of our colleagues who began writing at the same time or getting published, you know, have written different series, several standalones. And again, I'm late to the game, but
you got there.
I got there. You know, I'm like the tortoise and the hare, I always say, you know. And it was a book I had to write. It was not a book. It was something that just kept knocking at that door. And here in my little garret of an office, I have all these notes when I went to Paris and, you know, about the history and things people told me, something I discovered, bullet holes in a building, and heard the story where it came from. And I'm like writing notes and taking photos. And every time I would come home from Paris, I'd have all these incredible things that did not go in an AMA book. And as we both know as writers, sometimes you try to shoehorn all the information, and this was not shoehorning. This needed to be its own separate pile.
So tell us the story and how it came to you and why it was so important for you to write this.
Sure. Can I show you the beautiful cover?
Of course. Of course.
Can you see it?
Keep it. Wait.
I had.
Go ahead. Talk.
I had nothing to do with the cover. It was designed by Janine at Soho, and I just love it. And if I could share the incredible, lift it higher, okay, map, circa 1940s, as close as we could get it to the, you know, some of the street names have changed, but this is a Paris map, circa 1940. It's with some of the landmarks that the Germans took over, and it has the route of Kate Reese, my protagonist. And I just want to say that people always say, I actually walked and biked every bit of her route and the other characters. So it can be done.
Tell us how the story got to you. How did you figure it out?
Yeah, well, it's been a long journey for me because, as I said, I would be going to Paris and hearing these historical nuggets and these incredible things. And I knew they belonged, and I knew there was a big story. When I found in a history book a footnote, literally a historical footnote, and it said at the bottom, Adolf Hitler came to Paris for 3 hours. And then he left abruptly, never to return. Now, it was 2 weeks into the German occupation. Paris had been declared an open city, so it wouldn't be destroyed. Hitler comes. Why was there no parade down the Champs-Élysées with Hitler? Why didn't these things happen? And why, if you look at the YouTube video, which you can do, and see Hitler's, you know, turn around Paris and his whole tour, why there's a lot of things that don't quite make sense. But of course, Goebbels, his propaganda minister, who was the pioneer of faux news, if we ever want to think of a pioneer, you know, just edited this whole thing, and it was a big publicity coup. But a lot of it didn't make sense to me. And I was like, what? Then I read, if I can show another picture. Can you see that?
Yeah, can you move it a little bit? Yeah, move it up. Yeah, perfect. Get it a little closer. Great, go.
Okay, so there's Hitler on his visit to Paris, 3 hours. And on one side is Albert Speer, his architect, I think with the cap, and Arno Brecker, his sculptor, this guy right there. He brought his art team, and you can see they're in Paris. Now, you can see them in the YouTube video. But after the war, they both survived. Albert Speer served prison time, and they both wrote their memoirs or their recounts of being in the Third Reich. And of course, this was included, this visit. in his notes, June 23rd, early, like 5, 6 a.m. in the morning, that they came to Paris, which would make sense because it was a day or two after the armistice was signed near the Belgian border. Albert Speer, the architect, wrote that it was a week later, both documented in their books. And they were friends. This was never disputed. And that just, to me, it was like 2 and 2 make 5. Mm-hmm. Something happened. What if this hurried visit was precipitated by an attempt on Hitler's life? Because we know there were many, many attempts on Hitler's life. How he survived them all, you know, it's like a cat with 20 lives. So I knew there was a story there. I felt it was really plausible.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any reservations about writing World War II, since there are so many books about World War II currently on the market?
Actually, I think these books on World War II are having a moment, and they've been having a moment for a while. I'd love to read them. I know you like them too. But again, I've been working on this book for about 10 years, so it's kind of gone through different cycles. What came to me was that the stories and the anecdotes I heard and the pieces of information I found were real. And these were told to me by everyday people. These were people who had lived there during the war. Now, I have some friends, one is 90 years old, and he was a resistant, and I've been very worried about him because during the COVID virus in Paris, he's sort of been staying in his home, but I finally got through to him and he's getting food, so that's great, and he's taken care of. But the things that he has told me and other resistants I met, even a female resistants who are almost 100 years old now, or when I met them, they tell me about these things. And,
Give us an example of the kind of stories that you heard.
Well, when I met Jeanine, actually from Lyon, she was 96, and she was, we met for coffee. She was a friend of my other friend, and we would go to the cafe, and she said, I'm from Lyon. I was about, you know, I was a young mother, and I was working there in my father's printing shop during the war because my husband was away, and my father would give me something and put it in my bike rack and just say, go, you know, take this to, you know, outside Lyon. And she found out, she was at first bringing, you know, papers, and then she was bringing little guns that her father would put, you know, and she would be driving out, and she was a mother and she had children at home, you know. And she, I said, wow, you're so courageous. And she said, I just did what had to be done. You know, I wasn't, you know, And I feel that's a big part of what I heard you people, it was war and you did what had to be done. I also read a story about a British woman they found, oh, maybe 10 years ago in a coastal town. And this old woman was found dead in her house. Everyone felt terrible because she died alone and no one knew she had family. They didn't think she did. And you know, they're like, they have to give her a pauper's grave in the cemetery. And then people started going through. She had a Légion d'honneur, the Croix de Guerre, a British, you know, all these medals from the war. And this woman had lived quietly, never made a show of herself. And everyone said, well, if we had known, you know, we would have really wanted to talk with her. And they said, well, she took the Oath of Secrecy, the Official Secrets Act that you sign in Britain. And she signed it and it was like, you never speak of this again. And she took it to the grave. And there's a whole generation like that of people whose stories beg to be told.
So how did the character of Kate emerge? And what is her role? I know she's the protagonist.
Kate Reese is the protagonist. She's a young woman from Oregon. She grew up during the Depression with five brothers, hardscrabble life, rural Oregon. Her father was a migrant ranch foreman, which meant he moved around ranches. She had to work on the ranch. She had to also learn how to shoot to defend the ranch from feral animals and to hunt and, you know, for their food. And grew up during a Depression. And I knew, and her descendants, she would be a descendant of like frontier women, people who came over in covered wagons, because some of those Oregonians, boy, they're special and they're tough and they're of the country, yet they come from this incredible background. And for Kate, who is a riflewoman who takes a job as an assassin, we won't say too much about that, but that would be so, how could that be a normal, organic part of a character? Well, if she's someone like Kate who grew up in backwoods rural Oregon and learned to shoot when she, you know, was very young, shooting would be part of her life. She would be extremely accurate. Being resilient, because I think working on I wanted a character who could sort of roll with the punches. Of course, they're dealing with and how to come back and think on their feet. Now, if you run a ranch, just think, even present day or in the 1930s, it's snowing, you're in labor. What if you're having a baby and one of the fences break and the cattle are going to escape? You get up and you go and you rope those cattle and close that fence. You have no other alternative. Or if, you know, they need to be fed, you know, you've got a fever. I mean, the animals and your don't wait. And so I think when you grow up on a farm or a ranch, you know that you've got to get in there and make do and have it work, figure it out. So I thought that's the kind of woman that we need for this, you know, and a woman.
When we meet her, she's not an assassin, right? She's married, she has a child. What happens?
Yeah, when we meet her sort of meet her in the next chapter, yes. She is, she's married to a Welshman who is serving up in the Orkney Islands of Scotland. They have a baby, 18-month-old, and he's serving in the war, and she's working in a munitions factory there on the base, Lyness, in Orkney. And I actually, it was so fun to do this research. It's very hard to see. But they're trying to reclaim. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
You shut up.
They're actually trying to reclaim all the, it was this huge base and very important in the marine strategic from coming from Norway, which the Germans occupied through up there in the north. Very strategic. Churchill had gone to visit that when he was a minister of the Marines before he became the prime minister. So they're up there And Kate is working in a munitions factory, totally underutilized because she's a Marx woman, but she's a woman and that's the only job she could get. But she's also there with her baby, and her husband is there because he's serving. And it's kind of great for her because she's out of her prissy mother-in-law's house in Wales, and she's out in this beautiful island of Orkney where you hear the sea all the time, where there are these monoliths of the Vikings. There's, you know, all these farm animals and birds, and yet, you know, there's people around. So I think for Kate, it's a great place, you know, with her family. It's a bewitching place up there. So that's where she is when her daughter suffers a febrile convulsion. And then a lot of things happen, and there's an attack based in a German submarine attack on the harbor, blowing up a ship. It's a very famous incident. Thousands were killed, and it was a submarine that snuck through in the Orkney Islands. So that was a place to start. And she, I don't want to say too much, but there's a tragedy that happens. Kate is thrown, and just goes to work like an automaton, you know, automatic, you know, like machine. Yeah. And she really has nothing to live for. You know, she can't go back to America, right? It's during the war, you can't cross the Atlantic. She's recruited. She's got nothing to live for until she's recruited. And then she has a mission.
So let me ask you a little bit about plotting, because, you know, there's a way that we do thrillers. What was important to you as you plotted this?
What was important when I plotted this? Well, the time was compressed, okay? We've got basically when she attempts to assassinate someone, there's a deadline. Person who's investigating her, the German investigator, has 36 hours to find this assassin.
If it was that close a deadline, I guess. Okay, go ahead.
Well, when the Fuhrer gives a deadline, that's what they do. find it. It was interesting to have her, interesting plot-wise, to work within that time frame, okay, and which really helped in a way that I tried to go through the day with each character, hour by hour, a segment of time, because we you know, it's very compressed. An incident happens, someone needs to be caught. So there's a ticking clock, a ticking bomb. And then there's underneath it is this subtext of another betrayal. And, you know, who is the mole in the resistance? Who is the betrayer? And who, you know, So it was very important to always, I don't outline, as you know, but after a while I realized I needed on the walls here, which you can't see very well, but I made timelines, Kate's timeline, what she would be doing, what Gunther, the German investigator, would be doing, what they would be doing back in London. And I realized that in cutting back and forth, was a rewriting exercise. After it was written, I realized I would insert different time events and chapters.
That probably really helped the pacing a lot. Made it almost impossible for someone to put it down.
Yeah. And the stakes were pretty high, you know. So that was great. I mean, you know, when I'm writing the Aimé Leduc books, as much as I love them, there's always an investigation, there's her life, there's the baby. I'm not right. Those are not thrillers per se, but this is definitely, you know, we got life or death. We've got, you know, Nazis, you know, we have someone on the run, you know.
I can't say it because it's a spoiler, but I want to say that neither... Nah, I can't say it. You guys are going to have to read the book. And it is definitely a one-night book because you won't be able to put it down. I think it's your best work in years.
Thank you, Libby. Thank you. And you and I did many plotting sessions over this book. So
I know. I'm glad to have teeny little bit of there myself. But what was the hardest thing for you to do in writing this book?
It was getting to know Kate. Kate was the handle I needed to grab. At first, I had just said she would be this frontier woman, this outdoor woman. She would have this, incredible skill. And then I thought, oh, she'll be from Montana or Wyoming, and I'm trying to write that. And I knew a woman from Wyoming. Yeah, this is what it's like. I'm from Wyoming, and this is what our town is like. And I was, but I've never been to Wyoming. I've never been to Montana. But when I was going through all this, I was on book tour in Oregon. I live in San Francisco, so it's just the next state up. And I've been to Oregon many times. And I was talking to my friend Maureen there. And Maureen was saying, she said, we have some really strong ladies here, descendants of some of the people who came over in covered wagons and lived through the Depression. Why don't you talk to them? And I'm like, she goes, and second of all, why couldn't your character be from Oregon? And I went, you are totally right. Why not? Because I know Oregon more. I got to talk with her and go through the historical archives and the recountings of people, especially women who had lived on ranches during the Depression. Why did I make this so hard? Also, Mary Vollmer, who is another Soho author and who lives not too far away, we were meeting one time and we were talking, and she goes, my grandmother's father, my grandmother grew up on ranches during the Depression, more Northern California. And there was such a thing as a migrant ranch foreman, because of course there were migrant ranch workers, but there were foremen too, because maybe they'd work a season, or during a cattle drive on one ranch and move to another, because it was the Depression and ranch owners couldn't always afford to have many staff, And I was like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the lowest of the low in the ranking, that you can't even live and stay and grow up on one ranch, that you've got to be moved around because of the economic circumstances. And that, so that really helped. And also I thought, anyone who grows up with five brothers, they got a handle on a lot of things, they can handle stuff.
Yeah. What was the part that you had the most fun with?
Part I had the most fun with. Because I would pass this corset shop often on the bus to go to visit my friend in northern Paris, Claverie, and it's Belle Epoque. It's incredible. It is still there. I mean, you will go by on the bus, you go, oh my God. And it was a corset shop run by this family for, since the mid 1800s. Until about in the late 1990s, but now it's a perfume shop, but it's a storefront. And I was like, there is and I would see all these old corsets, these beautiful, silk confections, and thinking, there's so many stories here. I started to do some research about it and found out, yes, the corsetiers was a great profession that women had. Making for women who, in the Folies Bergères, the Moulin Rouge, for Josephine Baker, for Arletty, for the films, for stage. It was an incredible métier, profession. And you would go and you would fit the actress, and you would, they would have their own wardrobe of different corsets. And it was quite a skill. And it was just so, I don't know, I thought it was fascinating. And so that... when I wanted to set a scene there, and I wanted to have a corsetier
help Kate. I remember that scene. Okay. Yeah.
So I could use this, this corset shop, which you will, it's still there, and I could use the background behind and delve into this wonderful profession that a woman would do, especially a woman like the corsetier in the story. I mean, she has children, but this is her job, and what she does, and how you look at it in a feminine way. And it was also a chance to explore how Parisians who have often been criticized for wearing stockings and putting on makeup and looking good during the occupation. That was a form of resistance, mm-hmm. you know. And I wanted this character to kind of explain it to Kate, you know, like, yeah, we are resisting in our own way, you know, a different way, which I thought was a nice window.
So she's she's a really unique character, and you came up with a whole bunch of unique characters to people this book. Did they just come to you fully formed, or did you have to work on developing them in terms of where their politics were, where their feelings about the war was, what kind of people they were going to be, how they were going to treat Kate?
Well, I think I read too many John le Carré novels over my life, especially my father's. You know, I would find them when I was a teenager, you know, this bio came in from all of them and read them. And then, of course, over the years, and looking at them, to not have a bit of a jaundiced eye about the British Secret Service, MI5, MI6, you know, kind of whatever. And I'll blame Monsieur le Carré. But I think a lot was going on, and it was wartime. So for me, a character who would recruit Kate, the British guy, would be a man who is very savvy, who had served in World War I, a vet, who would be running a precursor of the Special Operations Executive, the SOE, which was, it was a seat of the pants, it existed, a seat of the pants organization. They took people who were not part of the old boy network, the elite from Oxford and Eton and all that, or from certain military. These were people who had certain skills. A lot of them were foreigners, like Kate, and they could do things and think out of the box. They were inventors. Can I show one more thing? I found this in a Stanford archive. I wasn't looking for it. I don't know why I found it, but thank God I did. It's an S phone. Can you see that?
Yes.
Is that cool?
Wait a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. So the S phone is something that they developed, ultra high frequency secret radio telephone, so that you could be making contact with people, you know, not like through your iPhone, but it's kind of like you could be making contact. And it's headset. It was an incredible way for the operator to face on the ground up to the aircraft to help them land. You know, we've seen all the movies where people are, you know, landing on a field where they put out all the flares and everything. And that's very, very dangerous, right? Because you're revealing your spot if someone's right. dropping. So these were different other ways. So there was a lot of very cool things. So I tried to use that and thought, how would they look at this modern technology, you know, in those days, and try to convince the powers that be, the military, who were really, you know, we've never done this, we don't want to do this, which I think resonates today. And Günther, the German investigator, he came to me because he was, who would at that time have this kind of job? It would be someone who grew up during the Weimar Republic, which was a, you know, time of chaos in Germany, and not having, you know, food. They'd have to bring wheelbarrows full of marks to buy a loaf of bread, or, you know, that kind of time. And he would have been someone who his mother dropped off. At his uncle's doorstep, didn't know his father. His uncle was a policeman. His uncle gave him order. He gave him cause and effect and expectations. And if you do something like this, this will happen. And he put food in his mouth and a coat on his back. So Günther always appreciated the regularity and that you could, if you plotted along enough, you will get there, which his uncle told him. So he makes a very, he goes up, he becomes, you know, a policeman because his, you know, he likes the order and he likes the fact that there's some certainty. When we do this, we have the evidence and we do the job, it will come there. Of course, he becomes a tool of the Nazis because of that time. But he's a very, very good policeman, a detective.
Was there a French investigator also? or?
Well, there's a resistance member.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe
it was part of this sewer network. Everybody wore a different job. And I have to say, Day of the Jackal, that film and the book by Frederick Forsyth, I think that inspired me because I watched it every year. I just watched it. But there's something about the government. They try to find the assassin for de Gaulle, and we all know de Gaulle lives, yet it's nail biting. And it's that point where they don't know, they're just politicians and they don't know how to find someone. So who do they call? You know, they call the top detective of the Sûreté, and he comes in and he finds the jackal and prevents the assassin. So I think there is something about that always influenced me. Not that this is the same.
But. Day of the Jackal is the only movie I know of where you know from the beginning what the end is. You know de Gaulle was not assassinated. And yet, you're on the edge of your seat during the entire film. It's an amazing film that way, in terms of suspense.
Exactly. Well, spoiler alert, Hitler does not get assassinated.
We do know that. Our time is over, almost over, but before we went, I wanted just to find out what's going on with MA. And when she's coming around again.
I'm working on the next Aimé Le Duc, which would be the 20th in the series. But there's 21. But okay, so I goofed up when I was writing the Aimé Le Duc books. I always said I would write one in each arrondissement. I actually wrote two. I wrote Murder on Ile Saint-Louis, which I know is one of your favorites, and another one set in this Murder in the Marais, which is both the third arrondissement. So I've got to write 21 to get every arrondissement. So I'm about two-thirds of the way done through a draft, and I'm really, you know, working on it this morning. And then I have an idea after the next day, May, to write a story about post-war France. Possibly
one
explore.
That I know about? Is that the one?
Pardon?
Or is that the about the one with the woman's name in the title?
Huguette.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited for that one.
Because Huguette is the mistress of Aimé Le Duc's grandfather, right? Claude. We've read Claude in the other books. Claude has a mistress that Aimé doesn't want to know about. And I've always thought, what is the mistress's story? So I'm really exploring that, a story about how the mistress became the mistress.
As I recall, you're pretty much done with it, aren't you? I mean, you pretty much know where it's going.
I know where it's going. Yeah. No, I'm working on that. Yeah, that when I finish the next Aimé, I'm going on to that. No. Okay. Very different. It's very different from this story.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I was so happy to write this story because it's been always there and I had to write it and I just had to, you know, and I wanted it to be a woman's story, not that men haven't read it and liked it. I don't mean it's only a woman's story, but I wanted a story of a woman who did things, not just men, because it's always about men, male assassins, women had a huge role. I mean, no one would ever suspect a woman like Kate. I mean, in the story, she uses being a cleaner as a cover, being an older woman, but you're not going to really suspect a woman with a bunch of eggs in her basket or, you know, with wearing a cleaning outfit. You know, that's the Robin Agnew was saying, was that some kind of, feminist thing? And I went, you could interpret it like that, but it's also what women know. You just blend in blend in with the walls. And then when you get to a certain age, you're invisible, right?
Right. No.
So use it.
Not us. We're right here. Okay.
Not us. No. But I heard you.
Never mind. All right. Cara, it's been wonderful to spend time with you. And if you're still listening or watching, you really need to get 3 hours in Paris. You will not be disappointed. It is an amazing read. And Cara deserves all sorts of kudos for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you, Libby. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everybody. And we will be back again next month with another edition of Second Sunday Books. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, stay well.